Okay. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I didn't think I was going to know anybody, but then I saw you. So, good to see everybody. I have a big mouth, so you probably can hear me anyway. So, my name's Phyllis. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Good to see you. I hope you have a safe holiday. Drink lots of water because it's going to be miserable. But, hey, it's not raining. My sobriety date is August 13th, 1993. I'm sure about the year. I'm sure about the month. I don't know about the date. I was a blackout drinker, and nobody told me remember that date. So when I did figure it out, when I did realize that you were supposed to have a sobriety date, that's kind of like what I stuck with. So it's worked all this year, so I'm just going to stick with it, you know. No reason to change it. My home group is Delaplane, Monday night, 7 o'clock. It's a step meeting. I make coffee. It's not very good. They're cheap coffee. They're cheap cookies, but everybody seems to eat them. And it's a nice group. We're very welcoming of newcomers and oldcomers. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I enjoy and am very grateful to have the opportunity to man the hotline. One 24-hour shift a month. It's not very much. Pretty easy. And I take meetings third Thursday of every month to Fauquier Adult Detention Center. And that is probably my favorite meeting. That's probably my favorite meeting. The women in there are phenomenal, and I get to leave. So that's cool. When I was a little girl, I did not want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know there was a such thing as an alcoholic, and I had no idea what that was. But that's what I became. I was born into a family, an upwardly mobile middle-class family. Dad was a civil servant who traveled a lot. He'd leave home on Monday, go on the road, be back on Friday. I have two brothers, one's deceased, one is surviving. He as well is dual addicted. He just came up on a year again, so I'm happy for him on that one. My parents were not alcoholics. They would have that martini before dinner, and each one of them had a large olive, and there were three kids, so one was always out, so I was always competing for that olive, so don't know what that was about, but oddly enough, one of my favorite drinks was a double Tanqueray, always a double, right? Double Tanqueray on the rocks, extra olives. In my family, there are 13 cousins on my father's side. Of those cousins, 11 are obviously alcoholics, whether they're in the rooms or not. Several of them have died. We have said, well, not we, it has been said that they had a car accident, they had a heart attack, they choked. But we all know that those are euphemisms. I don't think they put alcoholism on death certificates. And of the 13, there are three of us that are in recovery. So, I don't remember anybody in my family on my mother's side having any issues, and I've reached out to some of my cousins on that side of the family. They don't know of any, but on my father's side, there's cousins we've shared some information, and we put the pieces of the puzzle together, and we all remember Uncle George. So Uncle George was never without a beer can. I don't ever remember Uncle George being trashed, but Uncle George was never without a beer can. So I think it came from my father's side. You know, I thought about how did I get here? And I think part of, for me, my story was that because Dad traveled a lot and there were three kids and we didn't have nannies, you know, that wasn't the life. My mom was busy. And because my mom was busy, she wasn't as available to keep an eye on me or Mom was not a warm and fuzzy mom. Mom was the kind of mom that said, you know we love you by what we do for you. And I didn't understand that, just talking about my mother, I didn't understand that until I was probably sober a couple years, and I went to my sponsor and said, my mom never tells me she loves me, and my sponsor's first response was, well, do you tell her? No. Why don't you start? Oh. So I did. My sponsor also told me, start talking to your mother and asking her questions about what it was like when she was a kid. So my shrink has called my mother an ice princess. He has called her emotionally unavailable. I have come to accept that my mother did the best that she could with the tools that she has because she shared her story, what it was like when she was growing up. So compared to my grandmother and my mother's version of reality, my mother was a piece of cake, but she was also a piece of work. It took me about 7 years after I got sober to be able to have a relationship with my mother where she trusted me and I trusted her. But, you know, at the end, my mother was telling me, don't call me. And she was right. I was drunk. Who wants to talk to a drunk on the phone at 11 o'clock at night when all you're doing is going, you know, because I get lonely. I get on the phone and then I get a big phone bill. My relationship with my father was great. I was daddy's little girl. Daddy never said no. And that has been interesting as an adult female to have that in the back of your mind. My relationship with my brothers, I love my one brother, Jim. I love my brother David too, but they were fraternal twins. Jim was the saint. David was the spawn of Satan. I connected with Jim a lot. He was very studious. He was quiet. I was, but for a specific reason I'll get to in a second. And David was a bull in the china cabinet, just out there. Very vivacious, very outgoing, very much a cover-up. as a child, I had what was called scoliosis. And when left untreated, the degree that I had quite an acute case of it, I would be an irreversible hunchback if it wasn't for the government's insurance, talking about good insurance. And so starting in the fourth grade, I was always in braces, a little bit before that, but I was always in braces, so I stuck out, not in a good way. And there was, the braces came up. You might have seen people that have like neck stuff, right? And they have these big collars that are around. Well, that was all the way through my body. And I've had three operations, one in fourth grade, sixth grade, one in eighth grade. They broke my spine. They fused it together. I have an 18-inch rod. Each operation, I'm in bed, flat on my back in a hospital for 6 months. At home, flat. I could roll around at home, flat in the bed for 3 months, and then in a walking cast for 3 months. Now, that happened to me. Do the math. That's 3 years out of my life in a very important part. You know, I think people always shake their head, but I'm like, that's what it was for me. I mean, you know, I figured you guys went through something. That was just my version of it, you know. So as I'm going through it, I didn't understand how it changed my perception. I just didn't know. I was a kid. You know, you don't know. Some of us come from abused childhood. We don't think of it as an abused childhood. We just think of that's what my childhood was. But so I'm left alone a lot by myself. And I'm staring at ceiling tiles in the hospital, and I'm counting the dots in the ceiling, drop ceiling tiles, right? There's nothing else to do. So I'm left alone in my head for way too long by myself. I come up with a lot of crazy ideas, you know. And when I'm home, no. Mom understood I was independent. She said when I was a little kid, she used to have to flick my feet to get me to make noise. You know, because I was independent right out of the womb. That's just, you know, how I'm wired. But I stuck out. And that is a big part. And I have not yet met any alcoholic or drug addict for that matter that didn't feel like they were always that round peg in a square hole, that were always trying to find a place to fit in. And that's one of the nicest things, that when you finally settle into AA, when you finally make that commitment to being a member of this particular program of recovery. You just kind of have that moment where you just breathe and you go, I found a safety net. I've landed. It's going to be okay. I have hope, right? So never found that. And that situation of sticking out stayed with me through my freshman year of high school. Prior to that, my brother was killed by a drunk driver suddenly. Of course, suddenly is kind of stupid, but yeah. My grandfather died, who I was very close to, and my father died all within 3 years. So it sounds like it was bad for me. Again, I just kind of thought this is what happened in life, you know. Well, it was bad for my mother, and I didn't realize it until when I was sober, I started asking Mom about that. What they did back then is they gave people Valium. They just dosed you out. So people didn't go to shrinks. If you went to a shrink, when was this? This was, what, 60s. If you went to a shrink in the 60s, you were crazy. So people didn't go to shrinks. And people didn't talk about mental health issues much. That's you. I was raised in a family that you didn't air your dirty laundry. You didn't fight in public. You know, all that kind of stuff was behind closed doors. But my mother was on Valium at those major deaths. I mean, it was her father. It was her baby. It was her husband. And that all happened within 3 years. And Dad had cancer, so it was a drawn-out process. It was pretty messy, meaning it was not pleasant. But so my mom, while Dad's traveling, when he's alive, Dad's traveling, Mom's trying to take care of the house, trying to keep it together. Think of it, three kids all by yourself. You've moved away from your family. So there's a lot on your mind, a lot of stuff you got to get done. Your husband comes home for the weekend. You know, you're trying to reestablish that relationship. I just try to imagine what that's like, you know. And then you have the dust in the family. I remember asking my mom about what it was like when Daddy died, and she said it was no big deal. Excuse me, when Jimmy died, it was no big deal. And I said, well, it's got to be really hard. Dad would have to come home, take care of David and me, go to work, come back, take care of David and me, go back to work, come back to us and take care, get us all ready for dinner. And she goes, oh, it wasn't hard at all. Denial? You know, you create your own reality. So that's part of understanding who my mother is as well. So I'm in high school. I am no longer wearing a brace. Things have settled down at home. My father died when I was 18, so the beginning of high school was a point where my mother and father, they knew as soon as I got out of that last brace, because they knew what kind of personality I had. They knew I was I like to call it focused. Some people call it stubborn. I like to say that I have strong convictions. Some people call it opinionated. I like to say it's eloquent. Some people like to say big mouth and, you know, highly opinionated too. But I shared my ideas frequently. They knew that they better get a handle on this or I was going to be a loose cannon. So they sent me to a girls' boarding school. Well, it was a girls' boarding school that had a monastery attached to it. And the brothers liked beer. Well, what do you think I found on day one? Me and Patty Carey found the beer locker. I loved high school. High school was great. So I started drinking when I was 14 years old. Get out of the brace when I'm like 14 and a half, and I start socializing. But I start socializing like overachievers. See, for me, there is either on or off. There's nothing in between. And that was a challenge for several of my sponsors. So I'm in high school and I still want to fit in. Remember that odd man out feeling? I'll do anything anybody says. Thank God it was all girls in there. God knows what I would have done. Seriously, just a little nutty. And so Patty Carey comes to me and says, we're going to cut school. We're going to go, it's like a hot dog, root beer float kind of drive-in thing. And Margaret Barrett, Catholic, can you tell? All of them, everybody was Irish Catholic around me. I'm the Polish kid. Margaret's got her father's Lincoln at school. And so we cut school, and we go get the hot dogs, we go get the root beer float, and they got cigarettes, and they got beer, and they got something else you smoke, and I'm like, let's do it. because Patty and Margaret are going to do it, which then Noreen would hang out with us, and Mary Ellen would hang out with us, and I had an instant group of people, and they all liked me. I found my little, as Katie says, tribe, and we did all the cool things that made me feel different, and I felt like I fit in, and I felt like everything was okay, and I'm like, this is cool. We'll just keep doing it. So in high school, I learned that if you were a role model, nobody yelled at you. I don't understand it. I went through high school and never got a detention. I don't understand it. I remember one time I was a literary magazine editor because they gave you an office that had windows. Perfect, because you could hang your head out the window, and it was part of the common area that none of the nuns walked by, none of the brothers walked by. So you could sit out there and you could just light it up, light whatever you wanted. And you could just do it, and nobody would know. I was pretty bold. I did things that I got away with, and I don't understand how I got away with it. In high school, I lobbied for the seniors to have a smoking room. It makes no sense when I look back at it now, but I've only stopped smoking for 4 years, so maybe, you know, that's, I'm on that, you know, podium now. But I got away with a lot in high school. And then Dad died. By the time Dad died, lung cancer was bad. The end of senior year, he died my freshman year in college. Now, when I went to college, I didn't go in a local area. I went several states away. So it was a 12-hour bus ride. A bus ride on a Greyhound, that was horrible. But all through my father's service, is the last days of his life, the service before and after I was loaded. It's the only way I could deal with it. And Mom didn't say anything. My brother didn't say anything. Nobody said anything. They just said, poor Phyllis. You know, my uncle told me he'd get me a car. You know, people, I don't know. I don't know why, but I guess grief was a mask at that time. So I go to college, and I get in all sorts of things. Okay, and I was a very good student in grade school. I was an excellent student in grade school. I was a good student until sophomore year in high school, and then the smoking thing happened in end of sophomore year, beginning of junior year, and then by the time I graduated from high school, I was an okay student, and by the time I graduated from college, I was a lot of incompletes, a lot of pass-fails, no 8:30 classes, a lot of extra credit if I could. In my last year, because I was such a good student in high school, I took a lot of pre-college courses, which was a really good thing because by the time I'm a senior in college, I'm taking handball, driver's ed. It was a waste of money. And the college, I'm given a free ride, and this is a funny story, free ride to Case Western Reserve University, which is a prestigious Jesuit college, big bucks. You know, I would have had my ticket written if I would have gone there. But one day, I'm probably about 5 years into sobriety, my mom says, why didn't you go to Case? Why did you refuse that? And I look at her and I said, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. There are times in my life, there are series of months in my life that I don't remember. I started blacking out when I was 17. I started blacking out at 17 regularly. And when I say blacking out, I mean nine out of 10 times, which all the way until I was 37. I talk to people and they've never had a blackout. I'm like, how the heck does that happen? What were you drinking? You must have been a weenie drinker because that's, you know. I also don't understand why people run out of liquor. That's really bad time management. Just, you got to be prepared, right? You know, you open up one box of wine, you better have another one because you know that box doesn't last long. So I'm full blown by the time I'm 17 now. I don't even know that I'm an alcoholic to that degree until I had a good amount of time, double digits probably, in sobriety. I can look back now with a clear head, because it takes a while to get defogged. I don't know about you guys, but I was a person that for the first year couldn't say anonymity. I just would look at it like going, yeah. But The I got distracted there for a second, sorry. Yeah, full-blown alcoholic at 17, full-blown. No denying it. Didn't know it, though. Didn't know it. I did know one thing. I wasn't drinking like the other girls were. The other girls were drinking that just like sloshing down 3-2 beer, Ohio. And they're dancing with the boys. I am not leaving that table. I am sitting right next to the pitchers. I'm not going anywhere. Anytime there's a party in college, I am in the room where the kegs are. Why would you go anywhere else? It makes no sense. You know, and that was a pattern. I always knew what I was drinking, how much there was going to be there, how I was going to get it, when I was going to get it. That was part of the plan. And that became, I woke up, that was part of my brushing my teeth. This is how the day is going to happen. Don't know about you guys, but it's pretty similar story. But it's funny, you don't know what you knew until you know it. That's not one of those things like time takes time. I don't like that one either, but I understand it. I get out of college and I come back home and I'm living with my mother, and because I wanted to repair our relationship. My brother's estranged because he's doing drugs and drinking like a nut. And, you know, I'm left to my own devices, and I decide I'm going to get a job as a pharmacy assistant. So just pause there a moment, just kind of figure out what's going on there. And that's before they do federal inventory. So Quaaludes come in a bottle of 1500 and Black Beauties come in a bottle of 500. So that was a big nine step for me. That was a costly nine step. So I'm in college. First year, not so bad. I lived in what was called the Virgin Vault, and it was in a time when there were no co-ed. There were no co-ed dorms, and this was an academic unit, so those girls were weird in there. That's my mind. But I found Julie Schrefferman, I found Debbie, and I found Cindy Emerson, and we were the crew. We found each other. Which is what we do. We find our drinking buddies or whatever buddies. We just gravitate towards people that drink like we do. And that's what happened. And they introduced me to other things. And that started the college. So by the time I'm in college, I don't know how to socialize anymore on my own. And that continues into adulthood. If I already don't have something in me, and I'm not holding something with me, and I don't know that there's something there for me, I'm not happy. I'm not comfortable. I'm irritable. I'm discontent, and I'm going to make you miserable. But if I know I've got it in me, I know I have it with me, and I know it's there for me, I'm fine. I'm fine. It's my security blanket. But I remember in the very beginning of sobriety, my sponsor telling me that she asked me, Phyllis, what do you do for fun? And I said, well, I clean my toilet. She said, people don't do that for fun. And I'm looking at her like, I don't understand you. And she said, we're going to go to a party tonight. And I said, okay. So we went to this party, all women, And I stood in the corner. She came over to me. And she goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm just standing here. She goes, yeah. I go, what do you want me to do? She goes, I want you to go talk to people. I'm like who? She goes, like that one. And I said, what am I supposed to say? She goes, say hello. And then I'm like, and then what? She goes, tell them you're an alcoholic. They'll pick it up from there. I go over. Hi, my name's Phyllis. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, really? I am too. My name's blah, blah, blah. I live someplace. And where do you live? I live in Alexandria. It was hard. Without that security blanket, I don't know how to talk. I didn't know. So growing up in AA, you know, I had to learn how to be vulnerable, that it was okay. I had to learn that talking to strangers was not going to kill me. Nobody ever died from telling the truth. Wait a minute. You know what I mean. Yeah. All right. So that's it. It's just, I'm a sloppy drunk. You know, I try to paint the picture. I get this great job, my last job before sobriety. Well, I kept that job about a year after sobriety. Then I realized this was terrible. I was the vice president. Top shelf, Brooks Brothers shoes, company cards, blah, 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 candy company. I've got it made. I look good on the outside. I didn't know how miserable I was. I didn't lose a husband. I never could stay in a relationship. I had to leave relationships before they kicked me to the curb. Because who wants to fall in love with a drunk woman? I know what a drunk guy looks like. You know, I don't remember what drunk women looks like, but I can figure it out pretty quick. Not good. I was a blubbering idiot. I wasn't a mean drunk. I wasn't a nasty drunk. I was one of those drunks that kept telling you the same Mickey Mouse joke over and over again. And so you're like, just shut up. No way. Because I just wanted attention. Hey, pay attention to me. I want to fit in, please. So got a great job. I'm living in a condo in Old Town Alexandria. I'm living on Princess Street. Mary Chapin Carpenter's my neighbor. I'm looking really groovy, right? But I'm not happy. I'm not happy. I don't know what's going on. All I know is I'm not happy. I also know that I'm starting to get into some legal trouble with some regularity. My last arrest, it was the eighth one. They're all alcohol related. I was so close to the condo that the cops moved my car. I didn't learn. I'm not smart. You'll never hear me say I'm smart or sane, but in the last arrest, I blew a 3.8, so I had a pretty high tolerance. They did one of these, you know, looking at it like, you know, the BAC machine was broken, but, and I was a lot littler, but high tolerance. I remember telling the lawyer, I did not drink. I wasn't drunk. I'm never drunk. It's always two. I always have two. So the lawyer said, go pull your bar tab, because I was a bar drinker. Go pull your bar tab. Okay, fine. Eric, I need my bar tab from Friday night. No problem, Phyllis. Yeah, can I have double? All right. Yeah, put the martini down. I stopped counting at 16 drinks. Now, I'm a cheap, not frugal. I'm a cheap drunk. You can buy me all the drinks you want. You can, yeah. I am not buying you anything. You're not getting anything. Okay. So I know all those drinks were mine. That did not buy drinks for anybody. And that was in a 4-hour period. Now, those drinks are doubles because I either drink double Tanqueray, I drank double Tanqueray, or I drank St. Pauli's and a Cuervo. So my bartender was trained that either there was an olives or a lemon, Phyllis. That's all he had to ask me. And he knew when the glass was half full, there was another one that would be put next to it. And if the shot was gone, he would put another one next to it. And when the beer was halfway gone, he would put a beer next to it. So he never cut me off, and he never told me to get a taxi. It wasn't his responsibility, really, when I think about it. But I also remember that bar, and it was a long bar, a nice bar, like in by what metro is it? Anyway, it's a nice part of town where all the cool kids hang out, you know. And so this long bar, and over here, so all the cool kids would hang out here, right? And then all these losers would all hang out there. These are the drunks. These are alcoholics. These guys look like alcoholics. They were dirty old men, and they probably lived in a box under some bridge, right? Because that's what I thought an alcoholic looked like. And so all those guys hung out by each other. And I will confess to you this, that at the end of my drinking, I was sitting down at that end. All the cool kids were over here. Do you know where all those losers were sitting? They were all over here. I was left over there by myself. That's how cool I was. I was just a drunk. So a series of arrests. Judge didn't like me. My last arrest was on federal property. So I went in front of a judge in a federal courtroom, which is a lot different than traffic court. You're the only person in there other than the bailiff, a reporter, a recorder, prosecuting attorney, your attorney, the judge, a couple marshals. Yeah. I walked in there, oh, this is nice. This is a pretty room. Got all pretty panel, red leather. Where is everybody? Oh. First inclination that denial is now kind of crashed. And my attention, the universe has got my attention. So the judge was a newly appointed judge to Virginia's Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Perfect. Perfect. And she looked at me, and she realized I had spent the rest of the... Every time I got in trouble, I bought my way out. Somehow, I bought my way out. And as a career woman, I would pay to get out. It didn't matter if it cost a couple $1,000. Spend a night in jail, no big deal. I got used to that. In the morning, I'd get up and I'd look out. Oh, car's there. No problem. I would look out and periodically the car wouldn't be there. And I said, no problem. I'm a creature of habit. Sometimes I would not open my eyes, but I would come to, you know, that feeling, come to. And I would go, I'm not home. No problem. I'll figure it out. No, it wasn't a problem. For some reason, I thought that drinking like that was just going to be like that. And somehow I was going to figure it out, modify it. I used to say, oh, the reason I got drunk is because I was so thirsty. My mouth was so dry because I talked too much during happy hour. So I had to coat my throat. And that's what my martinis were doing, you know. Or, you know, we just got so busy talking, we never went in for dinner. We just sat and had the bar, you know. Or I wasn't feeling well, you know. That's why I got drunk. I would never tell people I got drunk because I was a drunk. I didn't know it. I just thought it was just something was off. I didn't know what that was. So last arrest, she throws me. I have time to serve, and it wasn't long. I actually got to stay in Alexandria for, because I've been in other ones, but Alexandria was for 30 days, and it was, the world was upside down. All the rules that I knew on the outside were not the rules on the inside. I don't like bologna in jail. I don't like powdered eggs in jail. I don't like the big plastic trays they have. I had long hair, and there was a woman who was in there for, I think she was in there for like over a year, because check kiting, she was writing bad checks. And she was like the only woman that looked like I could talk to her, because I was so scared about the other women. And because they were big girls, they were tough chicks. And I mean, they were career criminals pretty much, and they had that thug mentality. And I asked this woman, you can't take shoelaces or pins or clips of your hair or anything. My hair was in my face. It was driving me crazy. And I asked her if I could have some of her yarn that she was crocheting with. And, you know, I thought she'd give me, you know, 2 feet. She gave me like 8 inches. 8 inches of this red yarn. And that was like the most, oh God, I was so gentle with that for my stay. But I still have that piece of yarn. I will never forget that piece of yarn. I will never lose that piece of yarn. I can tell you exactly where it is right now. But in that jail, I was arrogant. As you can tell, I still have a little bit of a New York attitude. It's tempered quite a bit. I was like, it's not that bad. I'll be able to handle it. It's like day one. So I get up, I'm trying, you know, nobody's up. I get up early, I'm looking around, and, you know, everything's okay. And then I start evaluating it, and for those of you, because you haven't been in a woman's jail or the Alexandria jail, it's a two-tiered thing. Everybody gets, at that time, I don't know what crowding situation is right now, but you had a cell to yourself, and there was a door, okay? And I remember on day two is when the problem, when my awakening to what it was like in to stay at jail, when you're me, and that is, I put my feet up on a table, and I swear it was the biggest girl in the whole place. She came in and she goes, what are you doing? And I'm just like, oh God. I said, nothing. All that bravado that I had, I'm a cool kid, gone. And she goes, well, you're in my house. And I'm like, I don't understand, this is jail. I don't know. I don't know what to say. And I just kept looking at her, and I think that kind of ticked her off. And she goes, and your feet are on my furniture. And I'm like, okay, what, you know. And she held back her hand and took it and hit. So I fell off my chair to take my leg up. She was teaching me the ropes. She was teaching me, this is what it's going to be like. This is what life is like. And quick, get it. And I looked at her and I went, oh, I can't do this. I can't do it. It's the beginning of my moment of clarity. My moment of clarity actually lasted several years, but that was the beginning of, I don't like this anymore. This isn't going to work for me anymore. So for the duration of my time, I would get up early. I would do whatever I needed to do. I would get whatever I could get to eat. I would clean myself. I would do whatever I needed to do. I'd go back up to my cell and I would close the door. So I was locking myself in jail where I was already locked up so I wouldn't have to interface with the other inmates, because that's how scared I was and how much I realized I did not want this to be my life. Fast forward, I get out of jail. My lawyer picks me up. He drops me off at my condo. I walk in, and I cannot tell you why, but it made perfect sense to me to go to Las Vegas. Now, I wasn't a real binge drinker. I don't really like Las Vegas. I know I went there because that's what the credit card receipt says. And we had Compatini would have their company meetings, you know, their company conventions in Vegas, so that's probably why. But anyway, so, yeah, but when I drank, I wasn't a daily drinker. But I can guarantee you this, every time I started, I didn't stop until I came to. So whatever happened between the time I blacked out to the time I came to, I'm not really sure. And I really don't want to know. I never asked people, what happened last night? Why would you do that? You know, after the first ripped clothing or who are you or where am I? No. I really don't want to know the details. I just wanted to get out of whatever it was that got me into drinking like I drank for that period of time. So I could go for 4 days without drinking. I could go for, never a weekend, why would you do that? 4 days. I could go from like Monday to Friday without drinking. The first day was because it was such a bad hangover where you swear, I'm never going to do this again, you know. And then by Wednesday, you're like, yeah, so what's going on for the weekend, you know. And then I always had a pool at the house when I lived at the end. There was a house that I lived at. It was a group house. We had a big pool. And, you know, from 3 o'clock on Friday till basically 6 o'clock Monday morning, you know, it was just nonstop furniture in the pool kind of party. But so that's what life became. And I remember talking to a friend of mine saying, you know what, a lot of people get arrested 2 or 3 times, don't they, for drunk driving? And he's like, sure. So I told you my brother has 1 year. About 10 years ago he had 1 year, and he wanted me to speak for his 1 year anniversary. It's a big deal when you get 1 year. And I hope my brother, this is his last time, but it's his path, not mine. But anyway, so he asked me to speak for his 1 year anniversary. And I said, okay, well, you know, you're going to hear some stuff that you don't know about. And he said, like what? I said, like I've been arrested 7 times. And he said, well, no, you... Because my family, I didn't tell my family. Oh, mom got arrested. He goes, well. So I tell him everything, and I'm all done. And I think only in AA rooms can you sit there and go, well, I blew a 812. Well, I blew a 90,002. I've been arrested 20 times. I wrecked 9 cars, you know. So I'm like going to look, I'm looking at him like, you know. I remember I told you my moment of clarity lasted a long time. And he goes, you forgot one. I said, what? So he told me about a time that I was in a complete blackout. Didn't remember. But as he was saying it to me, I was like, dang it. He's right. I didn't talk to my brother for 2 weeks. I was so mad. Because see, my reality at one point was being arrested 7 times is okay. 8 is too much. That's how distorted, how perverted, how deluded my brain can be when drugs and alcohol are introduced to it in a consistent manner. I think up is down and down is up. I think that I'm entitled to everything and I'm never wrong. And you need to know all that. And I need to tell you over and over again, I am pigheaded, I'm obstinate, I am not nice when I'm drunk. I've done some things that have been mean to people because I was so insecure, because I thought I was an odd man out. I didn't learn about all those until I'm working on step work. So I am in Vegas. I'm not really sure what happened. I know I drank a lot. I stayed at the Flamingo because that's what the credit card statement said. But on the way back, I had the worst hangover that I've ever had. I didn't drink that morning. I don't know why. It just happened that way. Isn't it always that way? It just happens that way. And you could smoke on the flights back then. And I was on a bulkhead seat, and I was sitting next to these 2 old women that were just complaining about how much money they had lost and how crummy the room was. And they were just going, and my head's going, oh, and I can't crawl over them. And I'm just, God, get me out of here. And it's nonstop. We're not landing. I got to hear this for 4 hours. And there's a time change. I'm like, this, my life's miserable. By the time I get back to my condo, because now I'm the party house, that arrest, moved out of that because geographical cures are part of my story. But then I move into the house on Washington. And out of there, I go to the condo in Old Town. And so I get into the living room, and the room is blue. Blue like that man's shirt, the window treatments. Everything was blue. I can see that. And I sit down at my dining room table, and I'm like, I don't know what to do. I can't go on like this. I don't know what it is. All I know is that it wasn't working for me, and I didn't have a plan. But I did remember that my lawyer, before going in front of Judge Brinkman, said that I needed to sign up for CATS, and that meant that I had to give them a $1,500 check to sign up. I really didn't know what CATS was, but other than it was going to make the judge like me. Well, we know the judge didn't care with her because she saw the record. She knew what was going on. But anyway, so I sat there. I'm at the dining room table, and I'm like, I think I'm going to call them up. I don't know what CATS is. So I call them up, and I say, my lawyer told me that I should call you up, and I think I may need some help. And they said, well, this is CATS, Comprehensive Adult Treatment Center, something like that. And I'm like, oh. And they said, are you going through withdrawal? And I said, I don't know what that is. They said, well, do you have the DTs? And I said, I don't know what that is. And they said, are you perspiring profusely? And I said, no. Because that's really the only thing I knew. Remember, this is the first day now that I haven't had a drink off of, I don't know how long. At that point, I don't know that that's a 10-day binge. I have no idea. I didn't know that then. But so I am not clear-headed, let's say. So they say, we don't have a bed for you. And I'm like, okay, well, what's plan B here? And they said, but, you know, they gave me some information. I was supposed to call back and then show up and intake and all that kind of stuff. So I get into intake, and the doctor's asking me all these questions. And he, you know that pamphlet with the 13 questions? And one of them says, well, I answered everything, yes, 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 except for one question. The question was, did you ever think your life would be better if you didn't drink? And my answer was, no. Why would I think I wouldn't drink? And not that my life was going to be better, but, you know, it was all about alcohol. And I was like, no, I never. Why would I even entertain that idea? This is what you did as an adult. So what my parents did, they had cocktail parties. Everybody around us did that, you know. They didn't have the problems, but I wasn't thinking that there were problems. I was thinking I just didn't learn that skill set. So I show up for CATS, and I am in all white, and my hair is in a bun. I'm like the virgin going to the slaughter. I didn't know what to expect, so I figured I could play people. I could manipulate people. So I walk in the room, and there's probably 12 people. They all look like us. They're all neat. They're all normal, average, middle-aged, some a little older, some a little younger. They're all sitting around a circle, and they all come in, and the counselor said, this is Phyllis, everybody, and they all go, hi, Phyllis, and I'm like, oh, this guy's pretty welcoming. I wonder what we're going to do here. So started talking about some stuff. That was like group therapy. Okay. So I'm in CATS, and in CATS, I learn about what alcoholism is, and I'm like, I think I have this. And I like to think that I'm a logical person sometimes. And it made sense to me. I had a counselor who said, you know, if you have diabetes, you have to watch what you eat or you're going to die. I said, yeah, yeah. If you have heart issues, you got to watch, you got to exercise, you got to watch what you eat or you're going to die. I said, yes, yes. So, you know, if you have cancer, you have to get radiation sometimes. You have to get chemotherapy. You know, you have to be healthy. You have to really watch what you eat. You have to take your medicine or else you're going to die. Yes, yes. You have alcoholism. If you don't watch it, you're going to die. No, no, I don't want to die. So it made sense to me. I was then at another moment of clarity that I was going to be willing to do anything that I needed to do because I didn't want to die. I didn't want to hurt. And when I saw all those people in that room, and I thought, why not? Let's just give it a shot. Maybe this will work. I don't have a better plan. All right. So, ACATS was at that time was a 28-day program. I remember graduation, sitting on a podium or a stage like that, and I'm just realizing that I'm going to be jettisoned out there. You know, because when you're in a 28-day program, no cell phones. I don't even think we had cell phones back then. 25 years ago, did we have cell phones? I don't know. Brick if we did. But, and I'm like, oh, I really don't have a safety net out there. My family doesn't want to talk to me. You told me about the friends. Well, I don't have to tell my friends don't come around because I'm pretty sure they're not going to come around anyway. They weren't that great of friends anyway. They were just drinking buddies. And there was nobody in my life. I didn't have any kids because I couldn't get it together enough to have a relationship long enough to have kids. So didn't get married for the same reason. So I get out, and they said, you got to go to meetings. You know, we went to meetings in CATS. They took you to meetings right down there in the hospital. So I'm like, okay. Oh, sorry. So I found AA. And what I found in AA is a group of like-minded people that wanted something that I wanted. And that was to have a life that didn't have as much pain as I had when I was drinking and drugging. I am the person that cannot remember any longer how much fun it was when I was drinking. I don't remember. I got to tell you, I don't like the taste of alcohol. I don't like what cough medicine does to my brain. I don't like that feeling. I would rather tough it out and not take an Advil. I don't like distorted reality. I like hearing what reality is. I like people telling me the truth. I like being around real people. I like being around people that care about me. And I like caring about other people. And that's the kind of stuff that AA has given me. You don't get it if you don't work the steps. That's been my experience. If I'm not willing to do service work, I don't get anything in return. If all I'm going to do is not drink and go to meetings, my life is not going to change. I have to do the work in order to change. I have to work the steps. I have to have a sponsee because I have to work the steps. That's me. I don't know. I've had some people that say, I do the step one time and then I'm done. I'm like, really? Great for you. But, you know, every time I talk to my sponsor, it's a mini fifth step. There's something going on in my brain. You know, and this sponsor, she asked me, what do you want out of me? And I said, I want somebody that I can go to and tell my crazy thoughts that somebody's not going to tell you're a nutbag. They're going to say, you know, Phyllis, why are you doing that? Why do you think that way? What's your motivation? Call me on it. Call me on it in a loving, gentle way. You know, but it's because of the steps of the program and doing it with somebody that can help me guide through it that I've been able to get some clarity. I can understand why I became an alcoholic. I can see how it was just a series that ended up in the perfect storm. And I didn't have any coping skills. It wasn't because my parents were bad. My parents did the best that they could with what they had. That's it. I have spent years trying to figure out why. Chicken or the egg? What comes first? It doesn't matter to me. I am what I am. I'm Popeye. And what do I want to be? I can be anything I want now that I have the opportunity to choose. When I'm drinking and I'm using other mind-altering substances, there is no choice. I get up in the morning thinking, obsessing, because my alcoholism starts before I have the drink. It starts about me thinking about, when am I going to get it? How much of it am I going to be able to get? How quickly can I get it? Who's going to be there? When will it end? What's my safety net?